Hi, I'm Bob Acton, the host of the Color and Ceramics podcast. In this podcast, we are introducing you to top professionals around the world, as well as emerging artists. And it's in this regard I wanted to introduce you to Susan Trimble, a South African-born ceramic artist now based in Brisbane, Australia. Susan originally trained in graphic design and spent 25 years in that world, but everything changed when she discovered clay in 2020. Since then, she's trained under renowned ceramic and mosaic artist Jane Durand, worked on large public art commissions, and developed a practice that blends her design background, her love of painting, and her deep connection to nature. Her work is joyful, tactile, and grounded in craftsmanship, and she's already been featured in multiple exhibitions, including her 2024 solo show, Birds of a Feather. I'm excited to have her on board with us today, and I hope you really enjoy the show. Susan, thank you very much for joining us today on the Color and Ceramics podcast. We're really excited about having you on board, particularly because you're a South African-born Australian potter, and I would say that's a first for us on the podcast. And so aside from the fact that we love your work, that's pretty cool as well. So welcome aboard.
Oh, well, thank you for asking me. I was stoked. I actually couldn't believe that I received that email. It was like a dream. So this is brilliant.
Oh, awesome. That's great. You know, we really like your work. We, you know, I was really attracted to your colorful birds that you have on many of your vessels, and your Sgravito on the black and white Sgravito on your totems that you've got up on your website that we see, and I see that you've introduced some strings or tying things on some of your clay pieces, and so we'd love to chat about that. But I wondered, before we get into your work and how you do your work and sort of the details of that, if you could tell folks a little bit about your journey in clay and what got you here today.
Yeah, sure. Well, I grew up in South Africa, as you've noted, and immigrated to Australia when I was 14 with my family. And being in nature has always been my happy place since as long as I can remember. So when I was a little kid in South Africa, my parents, we lived in Joburg, and that's where I was born and grew up. But my parents rented a little cottage down at Vaal Dam, and we used to go there most weekends. And those were the days when kids just ran free. You disappeared between meals and came back when you were hungry. And those are my fondest memories, just running around the felt, basically. It was also beside a dam, so we did a lot of sailing. So we were outdoors a lot. And that is just my happy place and continues to be so. So then we immigrated to Australia and we moved to the Whitsundays, which was a remarkable place to finish growing up. I'd always drawn and I'd always painted and I'd always made. It's just, I think when you're a maker, you're a maker. I think that's just what you're born to do. So that was what I've always done. When I left school, I chose graphic design because I thought, my dad thought that I needed to be able to get a job rather than just going to art college and doing a degree in fine art. And I always thought I'd come back to being an artist at some point in my life, but I always thought it was going to be painting because I just love, and this brings me back to color. Color seems to be my language. It's how I process things in my internal world and how I understand things. Colors, there are so many micro, tiny little bits of shades of color, and they all have different personalities and they all tell me different things. So painting was always a thing, and I painted while I carried on being a graphic designer. And then, I don't know, in 2020, so we're basically COVID, I saw a workshop with an artist called Jane Durand. It was ceramics and mosaics, blending the two together. I dabbled in mosaics myself because I just loved the way you could put so many colors together on a board. But I'd never really tried ceramics, and I did this week-long masterclass with her, and it just pivoted my whole working life. Up until then, I was graphic design 100%, and it took me around the world, and I loved it as a flexible way to earn money. But it became more and more computerized until that's all it was, and I just couldn't. And my body was getting older, and I couldn't sit in front of a computer for much longer. And I suppose Jane's course came along at the perfect time. It was also COVID, where I think half the world got into ceramics. I'm not sure, but it certainly took off. And yeah, I was very, very fortunate, and I'll be forever grateful that Jane offered me one day a week to intern in her studio. So I was able to keep doing my graphic design to earn my living, which my family, my husband and I, needed me to pull my weight. But I was able to do this one day a week, step out into her studio and learn from her directly. And she's an incredible artist. She's one of the most intuitive artists I've ever had the pleasure of being with. But from her, I learned everything I knew back then about ceramics. And I got to be a studio hand, where you sort of, you do all the things in a working studio, because she had quite a large studio then, and lots of people were in and out. It was brilliant. It was so good. And that went on for about 3 years. And I didn't realize back then how amazing that opportunity was. I don't think you could find that if you looked for it. So I'll be forever grateful to Jane for that. But then she moved her studio back to where her home was, because she lives a bit out of Brisbane. And so it was time for me to kind of make a decision, and I took my studio home, and that was the beginning of 2024. And at the end of 23, I got another opportunity. Honestly, my whole journey has been about timing. I think when you're open to seeing opportunities and being brave enough, or motivated enough, and fortunate enough, because you can't always take every opportunity you see. But when you follow that path, it kind of compounds itself. And before I knew it, I was exhibiting with Jane down at a big exhibition called Artisans in the Gardens in Sydney Botanic Gardens. That was the end of 23. And my work sold quite well. Really well. And I suddenly, yeah, it was like all the stars aligned and said, okay, this might be something you can do. So in 24, beginning 24, I came home. I lost my dad towards the end of 23. And before he went, we'd been looking at trying to get me a secondhand kiln. But we just, I know nothing about, or I knew nothing about kilns, and buying a secondhand kiln was scary. So that really didn't happen. And then when he passed away, thank you to my amazing mother, they bought me a brand new kiln. And that was
Nice.
one of the pivotal moments. Oh, I don't know if you call it a pivotal moment, but that was one of the foundation moments in being able to build the momentum I've built with my work, because I'd let go a whole bunch of clients. I hung on to a couple, one in particular that I just thank God for every day, because he's my bread and butter. Because that's the hardest part about being a ceramic artist, is the financial side of things. It's challenging. So that I got the kiln. That was sort of my next moment. And then the third is something that I started at the beginning of this year, was I joined a mentoring class or program called Evolve, run by Amy Kennedy, who, it's just incredible. And it was the thing that I needed as a ceramic artist without the background education, to really analyze all the different aspects of my practice, who I am, why I do what I do. All that really, really important information. If you're doing this seriously, as this is now what I'm going to do, I don't even see it as a career, because I'm not going to need to retire. I'm going to just keep on keeping on. So, but if I want to make it financially viable, I had to get my head around, all the important stuff that would enable me to make work that sold as well. So that's where I am today. And you guys contacted me in April, I think it was, somewhere earlier in the year. And I'd only just started this course with Amy. And I was like, no, I can't talk now. Please come back to me later because I'm going to know so much more. So, and that is so million times the truth. I had such a bad case of imposter syndrome at the beginning. Well, up until probably May. But between Amy and the group that I've done this program through, a group of other artists doing it because it's all online, I'm just so proud of how far I've come, what I've done. I've never been proud of myself, and I'm proud of myself. So that's really cool. Really,
Very
really
good.
cool.
Very good. It sounds like you've really taken off. Like I sort of have this image in my mind of this rocket ship going to the moon, and it's and you're on it. So it feels like
I
that.
feel that way. I don't think it reflects itself in the sale of my work, but that's what I'm learning is there are so many ways to measure what you do. And I think when you're a creative and at the heart of what you do is making stuff that make people happy, because honestly, that is the kind of artist I am. I do want my work to make people happy. I'm not an artist who likes to provoke deep thinking, or I mean, I welcome that, but I'm not, I don't really, I want to share the joy that I feel when I make, and I think this world's gone completely and utterly bonkers. We've lost our connection to the natural world that has held us in good stead for millennia, for as long as we've been humans. And I guess this is my little part of, I don't know, feeding back into that. I just like to bring joy to people who look at my work, as much
Yeah.
joy as I have making it.
I think that's pretty clear. I think that's what we felt when we looked at your work was
Oh, good.
we felt a sense of joy. And I can really relate to you around this whole notion of the crazy world that we're in and how we're disconnected from nature. And I've got a real bug about wanting, no pun intended, about biodiversity and really wanting to pay attention to that. And it's a challenge to have conversations with people about that when they're looking at your work. Do you find that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It becomes a very, oh, you just get sidetracked. You start talking about, comparing your different positions on the environment and political things, just everything. It gets really complex and complicated. And I just want to make you happy. Just look at my work and be happy. And just birds and flowers, see?
Hey, now you mentioned something a couple of minutes ago about color and how you relate to color. And I think, in some ways, then I'm guessing that the colors that you use are imparting this sense of joy that you've got, and you hope to have it stimulated in others. And you said, oh, there's all sorts of different colors and they all have a bit of a different meaning. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I actually tried to think about this before our conversation because you are color in ceramics, so I figured it would be part of the conversation. I think I come back to the way I relate to color. It's sort of a little bit like when I put colors together or I choose a color on a particular work. I can't really articulate it. It's sort of like the inside of me or my making system. I have a very clear yes and no system as to those colors work perfectly together. And I'm not really sure why, to be honest, because I haven't studied color theory, other than the sort of the basic complementaries and all the rest. And I think it's obvious that bright, happy color, a bright brighter colors make you feel happier, and the moodier colors. I'm trying to take the emotion out of the descriptions. It's very difficult when you describe them.
But the emotions, I hate to interrupt you, but the emotions are part of it, aren't they? And
They are
totally.
so much part of it. And I think most people do respond to colors in an emotional way. It's just that I think if you're not somebody who deals with color as part of your everyday existence, and it's not part of your language, and it's not part of what you look at, that's all I see when I go out for a walk in the morning and walk around the neighborhood. My eyes are matching colors up. There's red flowers up there, and there's a red rubbish bin over there, and I'm constantly absorbing and looking at colors and how things balance each other, and the vibrancy that you get when different colors sit next to each other. And so it's just always been part of my mum's very much like this, and it's very, very pleasing to us when you are in a space where colors are all working with each other as against jarring or just shouldn't be near each other. So it's a really tricky thing to explain to somebody or to others. And I know you understand, but others don't, you draw a bit of a blank. But I think that the colors I use are exactly that. Because my work is so much Australian native flowers and birds, and we're blessed with the most amazing range of birds and, parrots in particular in Australia. It's just the colors and the designs are just next level. So there's always something to be finding in the bush. And originally, and I think this is why I do use the natives the way I do, because originally when I came from South Africa, I actually thought for the first couple of years that there was nothing in the bush in Australia, because over there that it's all about animals. I mean, they also have beautiful flowers and birds, but there's a lot more big, interesting animal life in the bush. And here it just was birds and birds and birds. We do have mammals and interesting animals here, but it's just a little bit more subtle and a little less dangerous and a little less, quiet. So the color in the birds and the flowers of the natives here, and it was a way that I could really get to relate and know my new country. And I've just stuck with them. It is always, also to be fair, it is what Jane's work is all worked around. She's also a South African-born Australian, although I don't know if she calls herself Australian. I'll leave that to her. But it's just a lovely way into it. And then my colour palette comes from all of that. So the greens I use are very rooted in the natural greens. There's not a lot of candy color, although that stuff makes me happy too. The way I work is a lot of layering, and you can see my graphic design background in it, which is interesting, in the sgraffito that you see on the totems that I do. So I sort of really do two streams of work. One is the totems, which I've designed a particular style. It's like a conical style made up of pieces, and you string those pieces on top of each other on a post that keeps them upright. And then there's always some sort of totem on the top, whether it's a bird or a flower or something like that. But they are a lovely thing to play with, because they're like 3D. It's a 3D canvas. I actually can't throw. I haven't got to that. I haven't got to learning how to throw yet. So everything's hand built. And in that case, in the totems case, it was just too hard to keep hand building the base forms. So I actually get a company here in Brisbane, an amazing company called Montelupa. They do some really, really good work. And Mandy out there throws my forms. I just tell her the dimensions and how I want them to be, and then she throws them for me, and then I get them back and finish them off, because there's a bit of finishing, and then I decorate them. And it's usually involves sgraffito. I find it a really almost meditative practice. It takes forever, but I really enjoy it. And there I work with colored slips, so I'm sgraffitoing through the colored slips, and that brings me that's a different kind. There, I'm not layering. I'm really black and white, or blue and white, or whatever colors I'm using. But it's then I put mosaics around those because I love that combination. And then they can go outdoors in gardens where they look beautiful. And I don't think there's any surprise that all the exhibitions, actually, yeah, all the big exhibitions I've been in so far have been in botanical gardens. So there's obviously a very, very loud connection between my work and that botanical kind of environment. My vessels are totally different because I use them to play on with all any new technique that I've seen on Instagram, because oh my goodness, you've got to control yourself because there's so much stuff comes through that. I play with different techniques and things on that.
So I've got a question for you that has to do with focus, because you had mentioned, doing this graffito work is kind of meditative, and I understand that because you have to really slow down and pay attention. And I remember years ago doing a lot of mindfulness meditation training myself, and then recognizing all of the opportunities that we have in our life to focus and to use a natural experience as a meditative one. I had horses, and so you have to be focused when you're out with in the field with a bunch of horses. It's true in the studio. So, and you alluded to how Instagram can be a distracting force for us because there's so much out there, right? And so how do you do that? How do you focus? How do you keep yourself from being too distracted by all of that stuff that's out there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure I've actually perfected that yet. I do have I think I hyper focus a little bit naturally. I think that's just me. So that probably helps me. That probably helps me. I really have a love-hate relationship with my phone, and with technology and social media platforms. I've seen firsthand the damage it does to young minds and growing people that should be out playing and instead they're not. But it also brings so much amazingness with it. So I use it for reference, and like I say, when I see different artists that I follow and I see different techniques they're using or different methods or little tips and hacks, that's amazing to see. But I don't when I'm making, which is most of every day, I'm listening to podcasts or music, and I'm not being yeah I don't get sidetracked by that too much. But I do find that it is very slow. That's one thing I'm learning, especially this year, how slow ceramic work actually is from, first idea to a successful finished piece. Because I've actually, from now onwards, I can't believe the timing of this podcast because I'm talking to you like I'm wrapping up the last 8 months of this year and all my learning with Evolve. Because I've learned so much about myself. And now, next week, we set up for an exhibition that will run for 2 weeks. So all through this time, I've had a lot of work to make and a lot of things to think about. And I've had to focus to do the program justice, because that was meeting twice a week and working very hard on ourselves and our practice. But in all of that, I've also been doing and developing a whole new body of work for this first exhibition at the end of August. And the biggest thing about it has been developing a variety of price points. So focusing has been, and that's why I said earlier, I'm proud of myself. I'll tell anyone who'll listen to me at the moment how proud I am, because it's not something you usually say to people, hey, I'm proud of myself. But it's been a really transformative year because of all of that. So I've been learning and practicing and then learning and practicing, learning and practicing. So it's had to be a focus thing. And there have been points where I've been, this is just too much, I want to lie down. Because honestly, I think I've worked every day, like 7 days a week for months now. And that's not unusual, I'm understanding, for people getting ready for exhibitions. Like, this is, it's just a way of life. It's not a career. So I guess, yeah, I really am very grateful to my husband for his patience and understanding, even when he doesn't understand what I'm doing, because he has given me the space to do what I need to do. And I'm kind of, my bench over there is full of almost finished pieces. The kiln's got the last luster firing coming out this morning. So I'm actually on track, and I don't know how that's happened, but I guess I've been focusing. So
That's
it
always,
just takes discipline.
yeah, it seems like it's always good to have a destination in mind. And so when you have a show coming up, I certainly work that way. I work towards the show, and whether that's doing something new or repeating something that I've done before. So I get that. And to have a supportive person or friends around you, like you've talked about with your husband, is really pretty critical as well. I got a couple of questions for you. I want to talk about pricing because I think people are really interested in that. Like when I talk to other potters, whether it's folks local here in Canada where I work or on the internet, many people are really interested in how do you price your work? But I want to, before I ask you that, I want to ask you about your use of tying things on your pots. And so you've got strings or leather. I'm not sure what it is, but I wonder if you could talk about sort of the idea that you had behind that and sort of, why you're doing that and how that works for those pots.
Yeah, that's I don't know, because I think well, there's a whole bunch of thoughts. The weaving almost always involves a bird at one end or the other of the string that's woven into the pot. And I think that is just a nest building home type of thing. There's almost always a theme of, I think you could go to town psychoanalyzing this, because there's definitely a theme of home. There's definitely a theme of threading and tapestries, the tapestries of our lives and how things. I'm so aware, I suppose, because I immigrated, or maybe I'd be anyway, how your life, all our lives, are made up of a million threads, and you weave them all together, and you, at the end, you've got your final masterpiece that was your life. So that's something that's fascinated me always. And when I very, very, very first started making my own, my own style began to emerge, I was coloring clay because I wanted to find a way to weave, even though I was doing it with clay. I wasn't actually weaving, I was coiling, like making coil pot vessels out of colored strips of clay. And I'd take a, roll a little sausage, and I'd squish it on the next colored bit of clay and make marks in it and just build vessels up like that. That was my very first one. And then I introduced mosaics because I just love the combination of mosaics and ceramic. But then there were holes, and I thought, what if you could thread clay through and in and out? And I never really mastered that. It was too hard. It kept breaking. It didn't work very well. And then I thought, well, I think because I've had no formal ceramic training, and I started with Jane, who's very, very spontaneous, very, give anything a go. I thought, well, I'm just going to put out, I'll leave holes, and then I'll weave other things through it when it's finished. And so it kind of grew like that. But because I've always got birds on all my things, and the birds is another thing you could psychoanalyze, I'm not really sure why they're involved all the time. But I do think there's this beautiful way of connecting our human emotions to something inanimate, like a vessel, through something that is alive. And I know my birds aren't alive, but to me, they almost are. And certainly when they get involved with weaving things through my vessels, that becomes even more. There's this implied movement. And birdsong, is really our first music. And flowers are really our first art. So I think, I don't know, there's a connection there that just works really well together. And then once I let myself weave something in, I think the first thing I did was some raffia grass. And once I'd done that, I you know, your mind expands. And suddenly I was doing leather cord and glass beads. And again, it's got to match. It's got to work in with the color. It's got to add to the vessel. You never want to just weave something in there for the sake of it. But something I've, for this new exhibition that we're going, that I'm doing next week, I've made a plate with a million holes all over it, and I've actually embroidered it. And that was a really interesting exercise. I don't love it. It's not my favorite thing that I've made, but I can, again, it's another step to you. It's like going into another room and everything opening up, and you're going, oh, I've got the possibilities of all of this. So I can see a lot more coming in that direction. I have got some vessels that I'm very excited about for this upcoming one at Marucci Botanic Gardens, because I've actually like stitched blanket stitch into the folds, like the joins where my vessels join, because it's been done out of thin slabs that then overlap, and then I've blanket stitched those edges, and I've got a little bird doing that blanket stitching. So that's it just excites me. It makes me really happy. It's just, I think that's all there is to it. Yeah.
It's when I listen to you talk, it really hits me about how intuitive you are with your work, whether it's the selection of colors like we talked about before, or the experimental components that you're working with now. And really, it's an evolution, isn't it? Really, as we work on pieces, your work sort of makes me think of something I'm working on now, and that's an evolution of what I'm doing, and goodness knows what it's going to be like in 6 months. But yeah. I really need to play with it, just like you have begun to play with it. But I bet you that pricing, as we talked about before, is not too intuitive. Like, you have to be a little little more thoughtful about that. So tell us a little bit how you, and you probably have had some support from Jane and this group you're talking about. So tell us about your approach to pricing now.
Yeah, that's a big challenge. And I think everybody feels the same way from what I can tell. And you certainly can't base it on how much time you spent on something, which is what my entire graphic design practice was based on. That was a really easy formula. It's really tricky. And this sounds ridiculous, but it comes down to, at the end of the day, that whisper inside me that says, yep, that color's right. I put prices all around. Firstly, my first step is I put prices all around it. Like, I try prices on myself. I put the piece in front of me and I say, okay, $300. And, you know, you have a reaction to that. So you slowly narrow it down until you're sort of in the ballpark of what you think you might be. Because I'm sculptural, I think this is really important. Production type work is totally different, I think, because, I mean, it has its same challenges, but a sculptural piece can be really little and have taken absolutely forever and be incredibly detailed and be saying to you, I'm worth a lot more.
But it's only this big.
Yeah, exactly. And so, or a bigger piece could have come together really easily and there's not that much to it. And so it's a real combination of what I think somebody looking at it might see in terms of the amount of work that has gone into it. Because I think you can tell without knowing what the processes are. No one will truly know, other than other ceramic artists, how much you spent on it. But I think you can tell when something's really being loved into existence, and importantly with sculptural work, is really unique. So I find a price that I'm kind of happy that I think I'm happy with, and then I'll try it on a few people that I trust their opinions. And that's where the Evolve group comes in, because I've got this whole new community of amazing artists that I call friends now. So that's a place I can go. I've got one particular buddy here in Brisbane who is very, she does a lot of markets, and her opinion's really valuable. So I sort of tried out on a few people. When it actually gets to where it's going and it's got its price on and that's what it is, occasionally I've kind of seen it in situ in a group exhibition and gone, I've got this wrong, and I might change it, but usually I don't. And at the end of the day, I really believe that there is a person for every piece I'm going to make. And when that person finally comes along and sees it, I do leave it up in the hands of the universe a lot. Because faith has got me where I am today. It's all about natural timing and believing in myself and just thinking if I keep doing what I'm doing, people like my work, and the most surprising sales have happened in the most surprising places by the most surprising people. So I don't underestimate anybody anymore. I think if you're putting yourself in the right places and you're feeling really good in those spaces. This is me talking as an absolute newbie, as an absolute emerging artist who really has no big runs on the board yet to pretend I know what I'm talking about. But I've not dealt with a gallery or trying to negotiate or navigate that kind of relationship yet, which I imagine will be totally different. But in group exhibitions where I've been invited and I've chosen to accept, or I've been part of the group that put it together, I'm really in the spaces I want to be in. And I see my people who are kind, gentle people who like birds and flowers and gardens and ceramics. Those are my people. So if I find my way to the places that my people come, I'm finding people like my work. And this next exhibition is going to be really interesting because I've now got pieces that are far more accessible in price. And I'm really hoping this will begin to turn some wheels because I don't have to wait for that one or two sales of a bigger piece. I can sort of flatten that crazy graph that is my sales, and be able to share my work with people who can't afford, the bigger vessels and the bigger totems. Yeah.
It's
There's
interesting.
no quick answer.
No, I don't think there is. I was reading an article by a sculptor the other day who makes big pieces, and not necessarily in clay, but she was talking about how she made all these beautiful pieces. They were distributed and shown in a big international magazine, and yet she was unable to sell them because nobody wanted them, she thought, in their home because they were big and expensive, right? And so we can set prices really high, but if nobody's buying them, then that tells us something as well as we move it. But you're right, we do need a range of prices to make it more accessible for people at the lower end, but also have pieces that are more expensive at the upper end. Because I think psychologically, some people don't want to buy something that's too cheap. They only will buy something that's more expensive. And so finding that audience, that right audience, with the right price is often a challenge. That's the hit or miss, experience as we go
It
through it.
is. It's key. And I did discover that my work's better off in an exhibition gallery feeling environment rather than just on a market table, where it feels a bit more like a market. My work needs consideration. People aren't just going to walk past and pick something up just like that, unless they've come there specifically to look for me, which isn't the case for me at the moment. So it definitely is that. And the other thing about the high pricing is I think you've got to, I did price some stuff too high, and You've just got to go, okay, well, nothing's moving. I need to have a think about this and constantly do those little adjustments. And then take into account, like, economy in Australia is changing at the moment, and you have to take that into account as well. So, yeah, it's a crazy ride.
Yeah, it's I do sculpture as well, and so I relate to you in terms of some of the stuff you're talking about. I know often a painter will charge by the square inch, so that's how they figure out the price that they have for their pieces. And then as they get more well known, they'll adjust their price per square inch or per square centimeter, and depending on what part of the world you live in. But for sculpture, it's hard. Like, I don't think I could do that by the pound, for example, or the cubic inches or centimeters, right? So I think that would be challenge. So this is a challenge, thinking about money and pricing and so on. You were lucky in a way that you had a career that you paid the rent, right? And I did too. So I can relate to that. But I wonder if you could talk about another challenge that you've encountered on the art side. What's something that that's really stuck for you and that you've had to work through?
Imposter syndrome is a
Yeah.
big one. That's a really, really tricky one. And I can honestly say that it took something like Evolve to help me get rid of that. Imposter syndromes, you don't get rid of it when people say, "Oh, don't feel that way. You shouldn't feel that way. Don't
That's
feel
right.
that
Yeah.
way."
Yeah.
That
Doesn't
doesn't help at
work.
all.
That's right. Yeah.
No, you need to spend time with people who are probably come from similar thinking, similar things, have thought similar things, and then be with those people for a while you begin to really recognize that your voice is heard, your style is appreciated, the things you say are valid. And just be with those people long enough for it, for the syndrome to wash away. And you realize that, like I realize now, that I am exactly the same person that felt that way, say 8 months ago, 10 months ago. I had this thing about the fact that I didn't have any formal training, and everything I was learning was on the fly and being picked up, you know, through my typical learning channels, which is either doing a workshop with somebody or listening to podcasts by all kinds of different people and listening to what they are saying. But yeah, I'm the same person doing the same stuff, but I'm doing my stuff my way, and I'm not afraid of failing at all. In fact, failures are my favorite things. When things, I mean, yeah, it's inconvenient and sometimes slightly heartbreaking, but what you learn from something that didn't work out along the way, or a decision you made that didn't pan out the way you thought it would, those are they're the best lessons, because you don't forget them, and you learn on every level that there is to learn on. You learn from them. So challenges, definitely money. Money is just the biggest challenge, because I wanted to do this seriously. I knew, you know, I have run a business. I've been a freelancing graphic designer for as long as my daughter's been alive, and I knew that I needed to make money to support this new thing I was doing. I also didn't have time, and that's probably a traumatic, but I did all of this at 50. So I made the change. I met Jane at 50. I changed at 53. I went, okay, 54. I said, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to give this a go and see if I can make it financially viable, which to me is really just bringing in enough money to completely cover all my costs and live on, you know, and money in the bank that my husband and I can share as he retires, because I'm never going to retire. So yeah, it's That's really hard. And so my husband's support, my graphic design, my one client in particular, and then my mum. And there I am just, that's just a God-given blessing that she's been my biggest support and bought me that kiln, because having that kiln is what has given me the momentum and continues to give me the momentum. And I remember thinking beforehand, like lots the years before that, I had access to Jane's studio. Very kindly, Jane would fire things for me, or I'd have to go to a paid service. And all of those costs just add up, add up, add up. And then you've got to buy clay, which was going through the roof in terms of price. And it's just, you can't do this unless you've got money. But the thing about money is that I believe it's how you think about it as to how it limits you. Because I think of the things I've spent money on. Was Jane's masterclass wasn't cheap, but she allowed me to pay it off in installments, and I made it count. Like I worked so hard to wring every little bit out of that experience. And then the kiln, yeah, my parents play a role in that. Even, as a 50-year-old, my parents were still playing a big role in setting their daughter up. But that was an absolute blessing, and I'm so grateful for that. And mum's continued support. She's my biggest fan, and she's my rock. But then the Evolve course was the same thing. It called my name. That's all I can say to anybody who's thinking about this. If something calls your name loud enough, listen and find a way. Because if you stop telling yourself, I don't have the money, I can't do that, you'll be surprised what comes out of the woodwork and what opportunities present themselves. Like the learning I got from Jane, I paid for that with effort and time and me giving her everything I had to give her. And I learned things that I would have had to pay to go somewhere else to do. So you've just got to believe everything is possible. Above my desk here, I've got one word, and I had this word before Ted Lasso. I've got believe. And you've just got to believe. It sounds so easy to just say it, but if you do think you can, and then believe you can, you will find a way, and the universe will conspire with you to find a way to make things happen. And I believe the more I do this, the more opportunities have come to me, the more things have presented themselves. I think miraculously, but perhaps not really, because if you looked at the big picture, that's what I've been working towards. So I and the joy it brings and the happiness. So yeah, there are little challenges along the way, big challenges along the way. But I look back now when you ask the question, and every one of those challenges, by being courageous and believing that something good is going to happen, like Evolve. It was hard to find the money to do that. And at the time, Amy said to me, this will come back tenfold. And she's so wrong. She is so wrong. It's come back a hundredfold. So you've got to just be brave to take those little steps that really call your name, I think. And those challenges, they present themselves, they resolve themselves, and then they go away.
Yeah, that's a nice story, because I think really what you're talking about is buying assets. So if you think about it from a business
Yes.
angle, right? We want to make sure that we're getting assets into our career, and assets produce other income, as
Yes.
opposed to things that don't produce income. They're not an asset. So a nice car or a fancy watch might be nice to wear or sit in, but they don't produce. They actually, we lose money when we buy them, right? And so your assets that you've been buying are courses and training and good quality materials and a kiln, and also the asset of your belief, and your strong sense of who you are and where you're going. And so that's beautiful. Thank you so much for talking with us, and I appreciate you being here today. And so thank you. Really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks for asking me.
You're most welcome.